This is quite, so quite a few years ago.
Yeah,
that was in Berlin.
That I heard Friedman.
Yeah.
Oh yes, that was quite a bit before Hitler. Even.
Yes.
Quite. I mean, it was in either in the very late in the very late 20s, or the just the beginnings. But I think it was in the late 20s. That I heard him in a recital. Mm. I didn't hear him with orchestra. I heard him in a recital, and but I don't remember what he played. I think it was a mixed program.
Yes, he often played the Mozart A minor Rondo and the Hummel Rondo Favori.
That I never heard, so it couldn't have been in there.
Bach Busoni Chacon.
I see.
Sometimes he played Beethoven's Last Sonata.
I see. That could have been, sometimes. And the Chacon could have been on the program,
yes,
I think.
Sometimes
but
Schumann,
you see, this is long.
That's a while back.
This is long.
But
but he was a big name in Germany.
Yes.
Big name.
I think he lived not too far from, you and your family were near the Tiergarten.
No,
we where were
not.
You living?
I mean, it depends what you call near. No, I mean, for walking to Tiergarten from us would have been, about 3/4 of an hour.
Oh, where were you living?
In Charlottenburg.
Oh, Charlottenburg. That's
in off the Kurfürstendamm, yes. Which they now call Kudamm.
Yes, yes.
And I looked this last year also at my old house, which is not destroyed, which
it's
is
still
very unusual. It's still standing.
Yes.
It just that one very little bomb hit just the middle. We had a corner, you see, and that the corner room, which was our big dining room,
yes.
That was hit. So that room obviously doesn't exist. I couldn't get in now. But they are planning a plaque this year, this city of Berlin, for my father.
Yes.
Because he lived there for a very long time.
Sure, from the beginning of the century till 33?
From about 1907 or something like
yes.
That, until Hitler, until 33.
Yes, yes.
And I was born there in that apartment. So, of course, it's very nice to have a plaque in an apartment where you were born. It's not for me, but still it's the same name.
The families.
Yeah.
Because for me, it's so fascinating, the Berlin of that time, because so many things contribute to one's music making and one's view of life, like your inner life being reflected by the architecture, the music, the theater going on, the musicians, everything. Causing you to grow and also you to observe the environment. At that time, it was incredible.
For music and theater, it was really incredible.
Yeah.
It was something which since then has not existed. I mean, actually, in sheer quantity of music, New York as well as London now are having more. Mm. There's no doubt. But the thing is, what was so extremely unique about Berlin in that time, in the 20s, was that the whole population felt that that is what gives the city its character. You see, when you went in a taxi to go to one of the concert halls, they knew exactly what it was about. You didn't have to explain what it was or anything like that. No, quite, they were proud to bring someone to one of those places for which Berlin was most famous.
Yes.
It was absolutely great. It was wonderful. And it's quite nice now. It's for me, of course, strange to come to Berlin now because it's a place which geometrically I know. That means I know exactly that there must be a street that way which has that name or something like that. But from seeing, I know nothing because practically all houses were destroyed.
Yes.
And there are new ones, so it looks completely different. So that is, but it's a strange combination. But it was for me a very sentimental meeting my old hometown.
And to go back, when you returned, that was after the wall had come down, I guess.
The wall was coming down just then.
That
I was there in May, last May.
Ah, yeah.
And the wall was just coming down. As a matter of fact, I was right where the wall was coming down, not one of the thickest places, but where the wall was the thickest. But it was very funny. It was teeming with youngsters who were all, they were picking away, and then little pieces fell off. And any piece about big like that was picked up. They put it either in their pockets or into sacks or so to sell it sometime to some old piece of Berlin wall.
Yes, yes.
was very funny. But it was, what was so nice about now was the good spirit, the happiness of the people. Mm-hmm. There was such happiness not to be an island anymore, and the expectation that it would become an extremely important city again, which is good hope.
Because even as an island, it still was one of the most exciting and progressive cities in Europe.
Have you been there?
Yes, I've had friends and I've traveled there on and off over the years.
I see. So you saw it. Yes. When was last that you saw it?
Oh my gosh, 4 or 5 years ago.
I see. No, that was still with the war.
But it was so exciting then to go across town, because you'd be in the most chic and progressive part of Western Europe, and across town would be like Moscow.
I know.
It was incredible, that contrast.
I mean, the contrast still when I was there was tremendous. But it was not a contrast in spirit anymore. What was so nice now is that even the policemen, I mean, the ones I met there, I mean, right crossing the border, they were, of course, still East German policemen.
Yes, yeah.
But they weren't any more tyrants or anything. But they tried to be so polite and nice, because they felt now they have to apologize. And it was very nice atmosphere. And of course, the eastern part of Berlin, in some ways, is the most important, because the big museums are there.
Yes.
And I went to the Pergamon Museum, of course, which I had seen just after when it was opened.
It was
about 60 years earlier.
Yeah.
That is that museum where a whole...
Yes, on the museum inside, with these...
With this tremendous temple, Greek temple, which
yes,
is...
The Pergamon altar, yes.
Yeah. No, but that again for me was so nice to have been there just when it was opened. As a 17-year-old or something like that. And then now to come back, it was very, very nice. No, it was a good experience, but the old Berlin really was unbelievable. And just as much for theater. It was not only music.
Reinhardt
was very important, but Reinhardt was only... You see, because Reinhardt was the best known one of all.
Mm-hmm.
But he was by no means the only one, or even all the time the best one.
Did you go to the Brecht Theater at that time? Were you
there was no Brecht
that?
Theater yet. What was there? I don't think
he
so.
He had a few productions.
He had productions there, and I saw one of the productions.
Yes.
There's no doubt, but I don't think it was called Brecht Theater yet.
No.
You see, right now, I mean, when we came there, through the Volksbühne, which was a very important place. You see, as the word says, it was a theater for the people, for the working population. In those days, you see, an average worker couldn't go to theater because it was too expensive.
Yes.
And also, I mean, he wouldn't have felt happy there. So there was 100 years ago last year, there was this theater was founded in the eastern part of Berlin, more or less in a workman's neighborhood. It was for us very far to get there, but a very big theater and a beautiful room and all that. And they had then absolute regular productions for the working populations for cheap prices. And my father liked that idea so much and felt that it was so much something that should be supported, that not only did he every year play a recital for them without ever taking any fee, but he also, for the very first time in 1927, the 100th year anniversary of Beethoven's death, he played for the first time the 32 sonatas there in 7 recitals, right in the Volksbühne, and again without fee. Now therefore, obviously, they still consider that my father was one of their big sponsors, even as he was not in a position to give them ever any money, or didn't even attempt that. But he gave him his work, which was worth more than just plain money, because he was quite famous then already, and his fees would have been very high. So it was that. So now last year, as it was their 100th anniversary, they made, among many, many other things, a memorial concert for my father. And as there are some people who knew of my existence, said, as long as you make a memorial concert, you have to do two things. First, do some of his compositions. which for my father was the most important thing of all.
Mm.
What very few people know is he didn't like it to play in public. My father didn't care to play in public. Of course, playing in public was more bothersome in those days than nowadays, because the audiences were not really very quiet. They were too restless.
They would talk more during the piece?
Not really talk. That they did in Italy and some other countries, not in Berlin. But they would shuffle, and they would especially turn their program books and things. That there was always some noise going on, a cough, of course. And also now audiences in the whole world are very quiet, except in Milan. But in those days, playing was not sheer joy, even as in one sense, playing was more of a joy than now, because pianos were still better.
Yes.
They had wonderful pianos.
Yes. You had a Bechstein
at
home?
And not only at home, but my father practically through his whole career played Bechstein.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, we played then last May a second concert, which was sponsored by Bechstein.
Did you have an old Bechstein available? Or
not an old one, a new one.
Are they still?
Yes.
Very
much a building, very good. They are still one of the best piano makers, no doubt,
mm-hmm.
even as they are not as big and not as famous as Steinway at the moment. But they built very, very good pianos. No, we went there, and they have a big building. Again, it was in West Berlin, but right at the border.
Yes, I remember. I went there once.
In Kreuzberg. You
yes.
may have been there.
Right by the
they
border.
Had a,
yeah.
yeah, right by the border.
Yes.
And but you see, for that memorial concert for my father, the second thing which was suggested is get someone of the family. Because that, I mean, then you have the name there, and so that makes sense, and so we played there.
What did you play?
I play only forehand, you know.
Yes, yes.
And so what we played there, we played only one group in the concert, the A-flat major's Variations by Schubert,
mm-hmm.
which is a beautiful piece. And then they did one of the compositions of my father for piano solo, which was played by a young German by the name of Litwin. He's very good. And he made now also recordings of my father's composition.
Mm-hmm.
For my father, composing was really the sense of his life.
Mm-hmm.
Even as during lifetime, his compositions were practically never performed, because they were quite a bit ahead of their time. Certainly so is Schönberg, but also Schönberg wasn't performed too much.
Yes, yes, especially.
Even as he was the most famous one, while my father was mainly famous for his play. So his composing, he did mainly during his vacations, my father. But he wrote a lot of compositions.
You usually went with your family to Italy?
No, we didn't at that time. As a matter of fact,
or Aldausse?
It's Lake Como. What happened is that Lily Krauss, I don't know whether you remember her name, she was a very faithful pupil of my father's,
yes.
particularly in the last years when he was in Berlin still. They had a very nice villa at Lake Como. And in 1932, that means just before Hitler came to power, a year before he came to power, they invited the whole family to that house. So we stayed for 2 weeks at Lake Como and liked it particularly much. It is very, very beautiful there. So when in the following year, in January, the Nazis were taking over, and by March, April, it became obvious that there was no sense, as a matter of fact, that it would be foolish to stay there.
Mm.
So there was the point of where to go for the summer, because nobody thought that by the fall he would be still in power. Everybody took for granted that this madness couldn't last more than 3-4 months.
Mm.
It did. So. At that time, then, I had the idea, as my father always did all his teaching from June through September, with exception of sometime in August when he went on vacation. And his pupils came from all over the world. As a matter of fact, there was not a German majority of pupils. So it was my idea, I said, why not trying to rent a house at Lake Como, which we all liked so much from the year before, and have for him to have all his teaching there during the summer. And then, of course, in the fall, after Hitler was dead or something like that, we could all return to Germany. He wasn't dead, unfortunately not. So there was no idea of returning.
You had to abandon the apartment.
Yes, of course. I mean, there was no point in keeping it.
Sure.
But
were you able to bring all of the music and the possessions?
Everything. What we didn't bring is what was large pieces of furniture and things like that, because it was too bothersome to move it. Also, they weren't that valuable or that good. So much of that there was sold or given away. But all the music got out, and all the books got out, and very much other stuff. Very much other stuff. Because that was 33, you see, when it was still easy to move things out.
Before the regulations started to...
Before, there were no concentration camps or anything yet.
Yeah.
That started only in 38. Also, what helped us is that we were foreigners. You see, my father was Austrian.
He had kept his Austrian
passport. And as in Europe, you are not getting the nationality of the country where you are born, but the nationality of your father. We were Austrians too.
And so your mother also had the Austrian passport?
She got it, I mean, when she married.
Through marriage.
Because that at that time, again, was taken for granted. All these things are different now.
Yes.
When a woman married, she got the nationality of her husband. Mm. Not the husband, the nationality of the woman. Oh, that didn't exist yet.
Yeah.
No, so my mother became an Austrian citizen too.
Yeah.
So actually, we wouldn't have been physically endangered before 38, when Hitler took over Austria.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, there was no thought of doing any work anymore. Anyhow, there was no desire to stay, because it became pretty awful. But you see, what so many people don't know, he never had a majority in a genuine election, Hitler.
Mm.
Not even 55%. The most he ever got was quite shortly before he came to power, that he got about 45%, which was more than any other party, but not that much more than the next strongest party.
Yes, it was just enough to...
No, it wasn't enough to get to power. What got him to power is that someone had to take over the government, and there was this man Papen, who belonged to the German National Party, which was a small party, very, very conservative. And he hated the biggest general in Germany by the name of Schleicher. And just to take revenge on that general, who was a particular enemy of Hitler, he arranged, through a lot of political arranging, which already then existed, that Hitler took over, not realizing that he would be would become a victim himself too afterwards. They didn't realize that this wouldn't be just another one who would take over for half a year, but that was a man who would eradicate everything else as a complete madman. So that was what happened, and that's how he got to power, but not by having a majority. Naturally, already the first voting, if you call it that way, after he was in power, gave him an enormous majority, but that wasn't exactly on the level. I mean, that was fixed, completely fixed.
Mm-hmm.
No, it was, I was in Berlin when he took over. So I remember still the fright which of all the people when for the first time he got a substantial amount of votes, which was about 3 or 4 years earlier.
What did you see in daily life that reflected that? More brown shirts in the street and the swastikas everywhere?
Yeah, naturally there were already brown shirts in the street before
roaming,
he was in power.
Roaming around.
But in the moment he came to power, they moved in a very different way.
Mm.
I mean, they were then the ones who were running everything. Brown shirts and much more the black shirts, the SS.
Yes.
The brown shirts were stormtroopers, you see, while the SS was more the secret police and those people. They really were much more powerful. But it was, I remember, you see, Hitler always had something like 30,000 volts. That's nothing in a country of, I don't know how many they had, 80 million people. All he had was about 30,000 volts. In the moment, he brought up the issue of anti-Semitism. Wildly brought it up. The votes went from 30,000 to about 3 million. Supported by all the other countries. All these other countries who were later the allies in the war, not his allies, our allies. All them of them helped them, particularly Mr. Ford, Henry Ford, and a lot of people in England. Now, especially the ones in Europe, they got it badly for it. I mean, because then when Hitler was in power, I mean, they didn't have much to live anymore. No, it was, what I remember, the frightening day, we always went to a certain house where they had a good radio already. The radios were still something unusual, you know, before 1930. And they had a quite big radio, and on that radio we heard election results of one of the comparatively many elections which had. And at that time, when we heard that the party had gone from something, practically nothing, to one of the strongest parties in Germany, it was just unbelievably horrible. The feeling of disaster. And many people felt that a disaster would be unavoidable, even as we all had the hope, as I said, that it wouldn't last very long. But already then, in the middle of the summer of the year, it was obvious that he wouldn't be out in any predictable time. That came then very, and then of course the culture of Berlin crumbled very fast. Mm-hmm. There were many people who understand who were not Jewish, like for instance the brothers Busch, Adolf, yeah, the violinist, and Fritz, the conductor who had Dresden, the orchestra,
yes,
who were Christian, completely Christian, and immediately left because they didn't want to have anything to do with it. Not because they were by any means communist. As a matter of fact, especially Fritz Busch was far right, very rightist, but not with these madmen. It had nothing to do with that. Actually, the rightists became their biggest enemies, especially during the war then. The people who tried to kill Hitler, you know, about a year before the war was over.
Was it Stauffenberg, the general?
Yeah, that one, and all the, they were practically all from the far right circles and the aristocracy, because they felt that this upstart, I mean, this impossible person, madman, lowly upstart, not even German. Hitler was not German.
Yes.
So, I mean, they didn't want to have anything to do with it, but they were all slaughtered when it didn't succeed. I was quite amazed. I had one sort of friend, I mean she wasn't a real friend of mine, who was very, very far right, a girl. And we always felt a bit ashamed of being friends with her because she was so rightist, you see. Her husband, later on, was one of the ones who tried to kill Hitler. Because they were his greatest enemies. That was German aristocracy, you see. And naturally he was killed then immediately afterwards. But she survived, I mean somehow she got away or something like that. Because they didn't stop of killing family members. You understand, I mean it didn't, if the husband of someone or the wife of someone was an enemy of the Nazis, they killed the whole family.
Yeah.
They did these things. No, it was, but just before that, even right up to the time, the music and theater life was marvelous. You know that my father at that time was playing all the Beethoven sonatas in the Philharmonic Hall. Mm. And about at the fifth or fourth of his seven recitals, Hitler took over. And he still finished the series, because we left only in May. But the moment he got to power, the radio was not allowed to broadcast the concerts anymore.
Oh, they had been broadcast up to that point.
Of course.
Yeah.
My father was a very big name, and it was obvious that there would be one. Naturally, not television, that didn't exist yet. No, at that time, radio was far more important than ever later,
sure.
Because that was the only thing.
That was the new link in the world between, you could hear other cities and
exactly.
Everything,
culture.
It
was very important. And in Germany, radio is still very important for music, for classical music, in contrast to here.
Yes.
Here, classical music is not that important, not even nearly as important as in Canada. But
there's no national institution which promotes it, tries to.
That is the one thing.
Sure, like the BBC would have. Or
No, I mean, also, I mean, even now in Germany, all the radio and television too now
mm-hmm.
is in the hands of government. But television still is not not particularly for classical music or so. Television almost throughout Europe is not the highest taste. Don't quote me on that in public.
No, I live in Italy too, and I.
Where do you live in Italy?
In the Marche.
Oh.
My wife is from the Marche, and we go there a few months each.
Oh, that's nice. I'm at Le Como now, you know.
Yes.
We didn't have a house yet. I mean, the house which my parents had before the war
mm-hmm.
was rented. But again, all the stuff we had there was saved, because there was a family of Italians we knew well, and there was a German girl who we had in the house always with her, not as a maid, but as a pupil of my mother's. She worked there, and she was Christian. And so she got the things into the mountains just about 2 months before the Germans came in, because the Germans took over, you know, later during the war.
But which mountains, in Switzerland or?
No, the Italian mountains. But this family immediately made a second wall in the cellar. And when the Germans came there, they let them through the house in the cellar, but they didn't see a thing. So the thing was all there at the end of the war.
Fantastic.
The only thing which was lost was my car. I had a car, a Topolino, when you know what that is. That was the smallest cars, which was just invented.
Convertible type?
Yeah, they were all convertible at that time. It was a very small little car, and that the Germans sequestrated, of course, because they wanted all cars and so. But we were, actually, the family was spending, my mother was spending practically the whole year in Italy at Le Como then, after 1933. And it was only when the war started that they had to get out, because that's when then Mussolini and Hitler got together.
Mm-hmm.
But again, as you probably know, if you have a place in Italy, behaved very well, very well. There were, of course, very few Jewish people there, there's no doubt.
Mm-hmm.
But still, there were lots of refugees by that time from other countries who had come to Italy. And the Italians saved many, many lives, as did the Danish people.
Yes.
There was only one difference between the Danes and the Italians. The Danes saved them for the sake of freedom, and the Italians generally saved them for money. Not much, little money.
Yes.
But they needed it.
Yeah. Also Bulgaria, too, they were outstanding.
Were they? Good.
There was the order to have all of the Jews deported, and the king and everyone else said no, and the Germans didn't press it.
I just heard the opposite yesterday about Romania, that was so terrible against Jewish people.
They were, until they discovered, they remembered their bakshish roots, and they decided, why should we send them to die? We could sell them. So a lot of Romanian Jews were saved, and they were able to get into Palestine.
Oh, because they got money.
They were paid for.
That was Romania?
Yes.
I see. I didn't know that. I didn't know that.
Half the people were saved that way.
I see.
That's why I believe in Israel now there's such a large Romanian community.
Yeah, I
and
see.
That
would be the need. And already, still very good. I mean, people who risk their lives, if they are paid and not very much even, it's still a very good thing. It so did Holland and the whole Scandinavian countries, but not Poland.
No.
You know that my grandmother was put into a... Is the wrong thing?
Yeah, it's good.
Was put into a concentration camp and killed.
This is your father?
My father's mother. Yeah, my mother's people were Christian.
Yeah.
And
where was she living? Was she still in Poland? It became Poland then.
No, in Austria.
Where's the town of Lipnik, I think, that your father...
Szczucin. In Austria.
Yeah.
And...
But is that today in Austria, or is it in Bohemia, or Poland? Or?
No, she was in Vienna.
No, but at that time...
Oh, well, he was born. They moved away when he was 5 years old. I thought you meant one of the politicians by the name of Lippe. No, that was where he was born. But
where is that town today? Is that town in
Galicia?
Yes.
And it's Poland, of course.
Yes.
But that was Austria at the time.
Sure, that was the...
And then they moved to Vienna because it was the thing to move to Vienna.
Yes, and his talent probably...
Yeah, and when you had talent. And that's where then all... And as a child, my father studied with Leszczycki.
Yes.
And stayed there, but he moved away when he was about 18.
Yeah.
Therefore, he wasn't liked too much in Austria because he moved to Berlin.
There were rivals then.
Yeah, quite much.
Yes.
Quite much. Berlin was an upstart at that time, but developed pretty fast.
Absolutely. Now, you were at the Hochschule für Musik?
I studied there, yeah.
And were with Kreutzer?
I was with Kreutzer.
How was he as a teacher?
Great teacher. There's no doubt. But it was problematic for me because the style of performance was very different from my father's.
Did you find him in some ways archaic in the way he wanted to?
It would be archaic now. It wasn't archaic now. It wasn't more archaic than for instance, Friedman played.
Yeah.
Friedman was in his style very, very much nearer to Kreutzer than to my father.
What was Kreutzer's background?
He was from Russia.
And you know whom he studied with? Was he with Essipov?
No, that I don't know. I'm not good at those things. You can find out. That's quite easy. But he was Jewish, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And naturally, therefore, he had to move out of Germany. He was still teaching at the Hochschule. Not me, I mean, I was out much earlier.
Yes.
But he was still teaching at the Hochschule when Hitler came.
Mm.
But then he had to flee. And I don't know whether he went directly to Japan, but he went very soon.
Yes.
And he became... really the father of piano, culture in Japan.
Yes, there was also another pianist, Leo Sirota, who went to Japan.
Yes, I know. As a matter of fact, I knew his widow here.
Yes, the sister of Hornstein.
Right,
exactly. She passed away a few years ago.
I knew her here, but she died recently.
Yes.
But I didn't know him.
Yes.
I don't know whether I could. He died very much earlier.
Sometime in the early 60s.
Did he live that long?
It was interesting. Arthur Rubinstein was supposed to give the premiere of Petrushka for piano, the adaptation of Stravinsky, and he couldn't do it. So Sirota played it.
He was a tremendous technician.
Yeah,
wasn't he?
Pianist,
yeah, that's why I never heard it. But must have been good.
Also at the Hochschule für Musik, I think, was Egon Petri still teaching then?
No, he was never teaching.
He had gone to Zakopane, I guess, by that point.
I don't know where he went at that, but I don't think he was at the Hochschule.
And Lamond was...
Also not Lamond.
He had left.
No, they may have been at other Hochschule in Germany, you see, but I don't know.
I think he was in Berlin. There's a nice story. Oh, I hope I can remember it. He was crossing the border to leave Germany. He was anti-Nazi.
Who, Lamont?
Yeah. When they came to power, he left. He moved back to England over a few years after. And the Gestapo asked him, are you Aryan or non-Aryan? He said, no, I'm a monkey.
Very funny. I didn't know that. Very nice. I heard him.
Mm.
Only once.
Yeah.
Played Beethoven Fifth Concerto.
Mm.
I heard him play. It was impressive.
Because he left recordings of Beethoven sonatas.
Lamont.
And they're very problematic because they're very quirky. There's no evenness in tempo. And he doesn't, he doesn't follow the dynamics always, and
nobody did it.
It's very impulsive and moment to moment. But it seems that if you compare Petri's playing, Petri was more orderly.
Oh yes.
Than that.
But Petri comes from the Busoni line. Yes. You see, but while Busoni, of course, in his transcription sometimes changed the text quite a bit too. Well, he took things very seriously. Busoni was a friend of my father's. Petri I met very late after the war in this country, when we were judging together at some competition here. A very nice person, a great pianist, of course, but a very nice person. As so often, very great people, very modest, extremely modest, lovely person. No, Petri, that was just quite something. Oh, Petri had a very nice quotation. A pupil of mine, a later pupil of mine, when he was about 16 or 17, had the great courage to go and visit Busoni. And he went in there, and Busoni was not with Petri. I mean, he went to Petri, not to Busoni. Busoni was dead. And he went to Petri, and maybe he wanted to be a spirit, but he wasn't accepted because he was much too young and all that. And he made the very naive remark. He said, "Mr. Petri, could you tell me what is really difficult for piano?" So Petri gave right away the answer. He said, "Difficult is what you can't do." that's absolutely right. He was a very great pianist. Yeah. But you know that he was the absolute top of all names in Russia.
Yes, he was the first to come after the revolution and tour.
Yeah, and he did that, and he became, everybody was measured against Petri, and Petri was considered the greatest of all.
Did you travel in Russia after the...
I was there in 35 and 37. Mm-hmm. After the, that's
touring,
after Hitler.
You were touring.
Yeah, I mean, if you call it touring, I didn't play that much. I played. At that time, Fritz Stiedry, was conducting the Leningrad Orchestra. And as we knew him very well, he invited me to come there. And I played also several times with him, with orchestra there. And those were my two visits in Russia, which was very interesting. Very interesting.
There were so many fascinating figures around at that time, too.
Yeah, I met Shostakovich at that time, a young man. Uh-huh. And he was at that time very depressed, extremely depressed. He was in what one would call a spiritual hunger strike. He had totally refused to compose one note anymore. He would not write anything because they told him that the way he composed was wrong. He wasn't allowed to compose that way. So his consequence was that he didn't compose at all. And I met him and I couldn't talk a word to him. You see, he spoke only Russian. But I mean, there was some translating and so, and we were both very young. It was a little bit older than I. And then, of course, they starved him out. He didn't have anything to eat anymore, until he was forced just to compose, because otherwise he wouldn't have gotten anything to eat. Mm-hmm. But after that, I feel that after that, his works were never as great as they were before that time. Mm-hmm. I feel that his best compositions were the very early ones.
Yes.
Well, it was quite an impression to meet him. I mean, it may seem strange to you, that's an impression to meet someone with whom you can't speak a word. But of course there were translations.
Sure, you communicated.
Yeah, we did communicate.
Yes.
No, he was, again, and there was, everyone was there.
Did you meet Igumnov or Sofronitsky?
No, I know the men. No, I didn't meet too many people because I was not in Moscow. I was mainly in Leningrad. Moscow only for a few days. I didn't like it as much as Leningrad either. Leningrad's very beautiful. I don't know whether you ever saw it.
Yes, I was there once. Yes.
It's very beautiful. And while Moscow was for me too Asian, it was more, I didn't like the atmosphere. Even as I had a friend from Germany who had fled to Russia. who was a nephew of the famous Liebknecht. I don't know whether you heard about Liebknecht, was one of the early
of the
communists.
Radicals, yes.
There were Rosa Luxemburg,
yes, yes,
and Liebknecht were the two big communist figures, both killed. Not by Hitler, but before already.
Yes, there's a very good book about that by Alfred Döblin.
I see.
Yes, November 1918. It's
that's right. And yeah, this one was a nephew of his, also by the name of Liebknecht. And naturally what he did, immediately when Hitler came, he fled to Russia.
Yes.
That was the natural thing to go, because he would be, I mean, as a nephew of as such a famous communist, he would be received very nicely. But he had to flee afterwards, because he couldn't take it. I mean, when the dictatorship became too strong, he married a Russian girl, had two children with her, and I visited them then. They had a little, tiny little three-room apartment when I saw them in 1937.
Which was a luxury then.
Tremendous luxury.
Yes.
And then eventually they moved another three families in there just to make life hard for him. And that's when he fled, and he fled to Austria, and then he disappeared. I mean, probably the Nazis killed him and they took over, because he fled before 38. No, there were a lot of terrible fates.
How about Erdmann? He was there during the...
Oh, I just talked about Erdmann yesterday.
Ah.
Because he used to do my father's compositions a lot, play them in the early time. And I knew Erdmann very well, very well. I liked him very much, and he liked me too. I mean, even as he was quite a bit older than I.
Does he still have family? I think some children alive?
There should be family, because... I mean, they would be grandchildren.
Grandchildren.
Oh, I don't know any of them. I knew him and his wife very well, but no one else from the family.
He's a fascinating figure.
Fascinating figure. But in many ways, I mean, also in some other ways, because physically, he was one of the least clean persons you could imagine. I mean, not clean, you understand, in the sense of spiritual dirt or anything like that, or emotional, not at all. But unbelievable slob.
Because Anna Vala used to talk about him often, and she just idolized him. And
yes.
She loved the way that he would go to the concert dressed in his tails on a bicycle. That was...
Oh, he was, it was going to his own concerts on
a
bicycle.
Yes, right, to play.
Oh, he was a great person, a good pianist. Now, I haven't heard him after the war anymore, but my wife did. She heard him play in Vienna, and she had not heard him before, because she was in America, you see. And she was very impressed about it. Yeah. Saying that it was an extremely strange way of playing. Yes. Extremely strange.
But
very
on its own terms, it was amazing.
Amazing. I heard one performance of the Polonaise Fantasy by him, which was the best performance of that piece I've ever heard. Yeah. It was just, I mean, overwhelming. Overwhelming. No, I liked Erdmann very much. He played in the 1925 big musical festival in Venice. He played my father's piano sonata. That's what came up yesterday. I had a long talk about that, because I was there.
Yes.
In 1925, and it created a scandal.
Hmm.
My father's music, and that's one of the reasons why it wasn't popular at all during his lifetime, was quite far advanced. And the most of the contemporary stuff they did at that Venice Festival was sort of in the style of Respighi.
Mm.
I mean, just, I mean, Brahms would have been a revolutionary there. So, I mean, when they heard that piece and that piano sonata of my father takes over 45 minutes,
yeah.
It was a scandal. Yeah, when people were screaming at who knows what. But in those days, you know, whistling in Europe is a sign of discontent. In contrast, that here, when people whistle, it shows that they like something especially much. There, hissing is still very bad, but whistling was even worse. Whistling was the worst of all. But you were not considered a success as a modern composer if the people didn't whistle at you. I mean, you had to have a failure to be something great. Mm. And there were plenty, and Erdmann was also as a composer quite advanced. Mm. No doubt about it. I had a very nice wife, very nice wife. Several children, but I didn't know the children. They were, I mean, children already, still, when I knew the Erdmanns. Mm. And then his daughter, I mean, at age 21, married a man who was over 70. Which, of course, I mean, the Erdmanns were not too happy about. But Erdmann was a great person. And he was, I mean, very leading as an interpreter of contemporary music.
He played a lot of Schoenberg. Also, he played some unusual pieces, some of Smetana.
Did he? I didn't know Smetana. Smetana, yeah. I didn't know what I heard him do very well.
And Mazursky, who was one of the first to play the pictures.
Yeah, that was. I didn't hear again the pictures of an exhibition for me.
There is a radio recording of him.
Oh, is there? Oh, I have to see if I can get that.
Do you have a cassette player?
No, but I can get to one immediately.
Yeah, yeah.
If you could make sure. Coffee for me, I would be very happy.
Yeah.
Because that would impress me greatly, probably.
Yeah, it's a bit. Eccentric at times, but it's nice.
Everything is eccentric with Erdmann.
But in a bad sense, but in a good sense, no, there are many of them. He recorded for German radio after there were many Schubert sonatas, which are wonderful to hear.
I see.
That, and then a few unusual pieces. There's a little piece by William Byrd, I forget which one. It's not Wills is Wild.
I see.
And a Handel, the E minor suite, which is wonderful.
But no, he's a great artist.
Also curious, while growing up, which languages did you read in mostly? German?
I knew only German, nothing else. As a matter of fact, that for me was quite a disaster when Hitler came in and I didn't speak anything else.
And did you pick up Italian when you were living in Como?
Very good. Because you see, in Como, we didn't have much contact with Italians, very little. I picked up some. I can't speak Italian now, you see, because now I still have a place there and I go there every year. But at that time, very little. But the one which I knew still most about was English, but very little. Mm. Very little. And so, for quite a number of years, I couldn't have friends. See, it was, I tried, I mean, with some of the colleagues who came there to Italy, also study with my father, and all. I tried to make friendships. But one couldn't talk about anything of importance because there was no vocabulary.
Who were the writers you liked to read in Berlin when you were living there? The contemporary writers or the classics?
Oh, you mean literature?
Yes, literature.
Not music. Oh, more or less everything there was. I thought very much in the dramatic field of Kaiser, Georg Kaiser. Mm-hmm. He wrote some very substantial things. And naturally Hauptmann, but Hauptmann, of course, like everybody who likes Hauptmann, likes some of his things and hates others. I mean, he was a very changing personality.
Yeah. Did you read Wedekind or Schnitzler?
Yeah, but later. Later. I mean, during my teens, it was forbidden. It was too indecent.
That's interesting.
That's right.
Did your parents read it at that time? And
they had it certainly in the library.
Yeah, but they told you not to touch
them. Yeah, and at that time I followed their advice.
Yeah.
And I didn't know, but I read them later. Yeah. Certainly, and I think, especially of Wedekind, I like Wedekind more than Schnitzler. But also, I mean, there are great things of him.
And then about in the 30s, there were so many changes in German literature. You had more of Kafka being published.
Who?
Kafka.
Kafka was being published as a foreigner. I don't even, they are not written in German.
Yes, they are.
Is Kafka written in German?
Yes, I didn't know.
You see, I should know that.
And Musil was
Musil, yeah, but Musil was German even, I think.
Yeah, well, he was in Vienna then.
Yeah, or Austria, I mean, we call that more or less the same. Yeah, Musil was, but I didn't read his book at that time either. Mm-hmm. But not because it was indecent or anything like that.
No, I only ask you because I'm curious what was in the air.
It was in the air.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. There was very much in the air.
And Die Fachow, the Krauss's magazine from Vienna, The Torch.
I was very little known in Berlin. But I was in Berlin, actually at the Volksbühne, at one of the productions of Cars. You know that he would always do Offenbach operettas, all by himself. He played the piano, would sing all the parts.
Incredible.
And you know, the first 5 minutes, it seemed ridiculous. I mean, you can still understand if someone plays a quartet alone on the piano, but a whole operetta, by the time he was through the first half act, you had totally forgotten that there was a single man on the stage with just one piano and not singing very well, not at all. You saw the whole operetta. It was such a personality. And I actually saw of him also one of the production, what was the most famous writer he did all the productions of? One of his own.
The Last Days of Mankind?
No, it was not that. It was another one. But he played in it himself. He played a young revolutionary in that. And it was a very good drama. You see, I got more to theater than I had than I read books. I was too lazy to read books or so. These are all teenage years, you see. But having this contact with the Volksbühne, where we got for every first night, we got tickets. And as my parents were constantly traveling, who got the tickets? I. So I saw practically all their premieres. And so I took part in the German Berlin theater life quite a bit. But not so much with Reinhardt and the fashionable things, but mainly through the Volksbühne.
Did you go to the cinema much at that time?
Yeah. Even this was strictly forbidden.
Yeah.
My parents didn't allow me to go to the cinema for many years. It was bad.
So did you see any of the premieres of Fritz Lang's films?
Yeah, naturally. But I don't know whether, not the first night.
The first run.
I saw. No, I made a film myself. Yeah. That was my great passion. And as a matter of fact, that film which was done, but 16 millimeters,
yes,
which was done in 31 and 32. It was a full-length film, an hour and a half.
My goodness, you wrote and directed?
And directed, not acted.
Yeah.
My brother was in it, you know he's an actor.
Yeah.
And I made that film, and actually I would have possibly ended up in film instead of in music if not Hitler would have come. But that made it impossible, you see.
Which studio did you work at?
No studio. I mean, as an amateur myself. Yeah. All myself. But as I was piano teaching, was earning a lot of money.
Yeah.
I could afford, on 60 millimeters, and it was a silent film still. Making a silent film, it cost a lot of money to make it. But
you still have the film?
Just now, 2 days ago, I had a telephone call from Berlin that they finally found, you see, don't forget that film, physically, is 60 years old.
Yes, it's.
And as it consists all of little pieces put together, there was a very great danger to find a laboratory who would be ready to make to take the responsibility of making a copy and not without destroying it, because the danger that it would completely fall apart was very great. And now just two things happened, strangely enough, at the same time. I was told by someone here, if you have a film and it's now in Germany, the thing is not to try to make a film copy, but video. And a day later, I got a call from Berlin through a man who is now one of the Berlin critics. Dümmling is his name. He's quite a musician, quite a great musicologist. And he was interested in my picture. And he called me and said, by the way, the right thing is video, not that. I said, I found out yesterday. And he said, I have it already in some laboratory. So just these days when we are talking, the film is being copied. And then I will get it here, but I mean, it's of course an amateur thing, it's ridiculous in many ways. But it was in the years when Feininger and people like those existed who did these very, very daring experimental films.
Mm.
Not something like the big productions like Lang or something like that, but the attempts to unite the art, the visual art and music, which was possible through film.
The abstract manipulation of images.
Abstract painting together with atonal music. And I was extremely fascinated by that. But as I said, my film was still silent. I didn't have enough money to make a film with Thorn.
Did you have the idea of having music with it at any point?
Not at that time anymore. No.
Or just to be on its own silent?
Though. Yeah, I mean, that was just a film. Then if something would have developed out of it, one might have written some score with it. But it was definitely a silent picture.
Did you study composition?
Oh, yes.
At the Hochschule also?
At the Hochschule, but at the Hochschule I was with Juon, who was a great, conservative. I mean, conservative is too nice a word, but he was really
reactionary.
He was definitely a reactionary, but he was a very good teacher. And one other of his pupils and I were his only atonal pupils. And it speaks for Juon that he was in a way proud of us. And he tried also to advise us somewhat, and he gave good advice, even as he felt that this stuff was nonsense. He didn't have any sense for that, but he felt that that may be the new thing coming. And I did various compositions during the time when I started with him, it were atonal. And he was very nice about it.
Just check how it's... fine.
They generally last quite long.
Yeah.
No, I was with him. And then another one, when I left the Hochschule, then you see I finished the studies with Kreutzer by being thrown out.
That's probably an interesting...
It's very sad in a way. I'm very sad about it because he was a great teacher and I profited enormously from him. I was thrown out mainly by contrasts between my father and him.
Uh-huh.
Not with me.
You were in the middle of that.
I was somehow in the middle and I was in the middle in another very bad way.
Mm-hmm.
You see, Kreutzer at that time had a lot of extremely talented and some already quite well-known pupils. And now, in our house, my father's house, there was not only music done, which was mainly by the parents, but there was also one other thing, and that was ping pong, table tennis.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was very interested in that, and I was not bad, I mean, I wasn't good in it, but I was quite good. And we constantly had ping pong tournaments in there. And practically all because my friends then were all from the Hochschule. So practically the whole class of Kreutzer came to play ping pong at my father's apartment. Now my father was teaching in the room which was next to the room where which was only big enough for the ping pong table. So naturally we couldn't play there while he was teaching. So the playing was generally arranged. He was teaching always in the morning.
Yeah.
And our playing was arranged when he was finished. But my father was not a person who kept very much to time.
Uh-huh.
So very often when he was supposed to be finished at 1:30, he finished at 3.
Everyone waited silently then.
So we had to wait silently in the next room. And of course, there was a drifting into his room because he always had all pupils listening in all his own pupils.
Yeah.
And so many of these Kreutzer pupils asked whether they could listen in. And quite a few of them were interested in him, what was fascinating.
And left
defected.
Yeah.
They left Kreutzer. So I was there, a kind of Trojan horse in there, that I came in there and I pulled the pupils away from him.
Mm-hmm.
That was the main reason why I threw me out, because it was impossible. I mean, nowadays I fully see that Kreutzer was perfectly right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was no situation. But I never thought that there was something wrong with it because they came because of ping pong and not because of my father's teaching.
Yeah.
But there were quite a few of them who were, I mean, Riebensam, for instance, was starting out as a Kreutzer pupil and became my father's pupil. So was Franz Osborne, who unfortunately died very early. And he went then to England, was quite well known there, but already as a pupil of my father's. Yeah. While he also started out as a Kreutzer pupil. There were quite a few others. So it was a problem. But in any case, I had already planned to stop the studies of piano about that time. So when I was eliminated by Kreutzer, that was not a great shock, because I wanted to go, on my father's wish, into the conducting classes. Mm. And then I studied for 2 years with Prüver, who was the conducting
yes.
teacher at the Hochschule, a wonderful teacher. But I had never any talent for conducting. I'm just totally hopeless for conducting. The few times when I conducted the school orchestra also were disasters, total disasters. It didn't interest me too much, Anna. It's my father who wanted, because he realized how difficult it would be for me to try to make a career as a pianist with his name. And therefore, I tried to get into it, but after 2 years, very tactfully, my teachers and some of the other people around talked to my father and said, can't you try to make him get back to the piano? He does it much better. Conducting is not really his field. It wasn't. Mm-hmm. So after 2 years, I gave that up. But during those 2 years, I had quite a few classes with a teacher by the name of Gmeindl, not Grindel, Gmeindl, mm-hmm. who was, in contrast to Johann, very advanced. Mm. He loved